Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have a special episode for you in part two of our look at the battle over the UFO file. My guest is Oxford scholar and Giza Death Star book series author Dr. Joseph Farrell. Today he reveals that some of the trends we've seen towards UFO disclosure from the CIA, which the media suddenly wraps in a bow for us to believe in an alien threat, is part of a much deeper play. Dr. Farrell sees this effort as pointing to the fact that players inside and outside of government are preparing to reveal some exotic technology and need a fake alien threat narrative to create the ultimate fear scenario. In an amazing twist, Dr. Farrell sees the final goal as a complete takeover of the financial system, as the ultimate power play for world domination. Will the UFO file emerge as the wild card chip, or have the players lost control of the game? Let's go ask Dr. Joseph Farrell. Joseph, it's great to have you back with us to discuss the endgame of the UFO file. Now, I wanted to start right off the bat with an article that you recently covered on a very unusual Navy patent.
Yes.
And this will get us into that X.
Yeah, it does. You know, I'm constantly amazed at the people on my website that find all of these articles. So I get this article sent to me by one of my website members and says, you got to look at this patent. So I looked at the patent. And Daniel, right up front on this patent application, let me see if I can pull up my blog about this. Right up front on this patent application, it says boldly and clearly that it's an electrostatic generator, okay, to generate electricity. But the amounts of electricity it's talking about generating are just way off the charts. We're into septillion, that's 28 zeros, folks, behind the one. Septillion watts per square meter of energy that they're claiming that this thing can generate. But in addition to that, it starts out this way. And these are the first two paragraphs in this patent application. Quote, the invention described herein may be manufactured and used by or for the government of the United States of America for governmental purposes without payment of any royalties thereon or therefore. Paragraph two, to date, there are more than 100,000 potentially dangerous asteroids which cross the Earth's orbit, with only 11,000 having been cataloged and currently tracked. Earth will be impacted again and again. It is only a matter of time and circumstance. Therefore, there is need for an effective method to deflect or destroy these potentially dangerous asteroids. So the patent goes on from there, but in other words, the purpose for it, the uppermost purpose for it in this guy's mind who came up with this electrostatic generator to generate septillions of watts per square meter, you know, that'll fry your dinner, folks. But anyway, is for the purpose of asteroid defense, mm-hmm. either by deflecting or destroying them. And I'm thinking, wow.
Yeah.
Absolutely wow. And that's a public record patent. So again, you know, that's abstract remarkable. From that. Yeah, it's totally remarkable. It's totally remarkable. And the patent goes on to say, oh, we could use this for other purposes too, like missile defense and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, okay, if you have a patent that is claiming the ability to deflect asteroids through generation of extremely powerful electrostatic fields, then you've also got the first step, thinking Hans Kammler-ish here, in the technology tree to grab and snab an asteroid and throw it at somebody.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, we're back to Rosen's affidavit here. We're back to Medvedev, you know, saying, oh, yeah, we can go out there and get rid of these things with other means. And then Chelyabinsk happens. And then Bridenstine 6 years later says, oh, yeah, and we were tracking this other object that didn't land. Okay. Okay. So what are we doing? Are we zapping it? Did somebody grab and throw the Chelyabinsk meteor? You know, on and on we could go.
Wow.
And in connection with that, let's not forget that strange occurrence right around the same time frame, within a few months of the Chelyabinsk meteor incident, of the Russian and American satellites colliding. Well, you know, Russia and America don't put up satellites so that they collide with each other. So, you know, either we're testing some pretty sophisticated anti-satellite maneuvering capability, or someone's up there messing around with orbits of satellites. Yeah. Well, how do you do that? Well, you change the properties of the orbit. How do you do that? Well, you can do it through electrostatic field generation means. That's how.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So grab and snag a satellite and grab and snag an asteroid. It's basically the same principle.
Oh, that's fascinating. When you look at it from that detail, there's been so many fireballs also. Mm-hmm. It's like everywhere you turn around, there's a story about a fireball landing in Cuba. You know, fireballs over South America. It's like it really makes you wonder about exactly the activities and operations in space.
Exactly. Well, let's go back to the Varro edition.
Right.
Okay, let's go back to Carlos Allende and his crazy marginalia in Jessup's book that is privately published by the U.S. Navy and circulated to interested parties in the Pentagon, mm-hmm. like von Braun. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Allende notes in the marginalia, and I cite this in Secrets of the Unified Field, is what he calls the Great Bombardment. Those are his terms. And what he means by the Great Bombardment is that, well, somebody was fighting wars a long time ago, and how were they doing it? Well, they were grabbing and snagging asteroids and lobbing them at each other.
Wow. Yeah, right.
So there we go. We're back excellent. To square one.
Excellent point. This throwing asteroids.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed in relation to all this kind of came out of the blue was the Americans pulling out of the Reagan-Gorbachev nuclear treaty, which I found unusual in one sense, and everybody suddenly wanting to make new and better nukes after we know some 30 some odd years ago with Reagan and Gorbachev, they were talking about going to none.
Right.
Actually zero, which means they had something else.
Yeah, exactly. They had something else. And, you know, that's always the way I took that. You know, neither one of those men would have been willing to compromise their nation's national security by getting rid of all of their nuclear weapons unless they had Medvedev, again, other means.
Yes.
You know, so other means here implies a strategic offensive capability that is similar in its power to thermonuclear weapons, but probably doesn't have all of the residual fallout effects, if you know, not to coin a pun. And if that's the case, then it appears to me like what they did by abrogating that whole negotiation that Gorbachev and Reagan conducted was, well, we've got to keep the narrative going a little bit longer. We can't reveal this stuff now for whatever reason. Probably we're not ready. Mm-hmm. And we've got to go back to updating the nuclear arsenal, which, you know, both sides have been doing. So there's no doubt in my mind at all that you're correct there, that this is exactly what it meant and exactly what it implied.
The zero option. It hangs out there. It's their
right.
history, kind of reflecting back. How could it be anything but?
Well, let's remember what Philip Corso said in his book The Day After Roswell.
Right.
You know, a nutty book if there ever was one. But it's so full of little nuggets that you cannot simply dismiss it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Corso says in the book is that the whole doctrine of mutually assured destruction, building thousands of thermonuclear warheads that would simply lay waste, you know, to the opponent and most of the planet, was really being done as an ET invasion defense threat. Okay, you invade the Soviet Union, we've got so many warheads, we'll just take out the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't care how much exotic technology you've got. Some of those warheads will make it through. It was simply a numbers versus quality game. So that, you know, he comes right out and says this. And the zero option then means that Gorbachev and Reagan were planning to scuttle that whole hidden motivation for having all of those nuclear weapons. And again, they were not quite ready to do it at that juncture. But now we've got electrostatic generators that apparently can generate septillions of,
yeah, right.
of watts of power. Okay. don't put that on your microwave tabletop, folks. You'll fry your neighborhood. But anyway.
it's a little like Element 115.
Yes, it's exactly. Well, yeah, we're gonna get there.
We're gonna get there. Let me try this. They were working on this theory that they could disarm the nuclear aspect because they had this other thing. And sitting right in the middle of that is the SDI Star Wars proclamation program and all these things that came up with them discussing it.
Yes.
So does it mean, in essence, of course, there's a lot of reasons why Star Wars could have been created in the first place.
Yes.
But does it mean, in fact, that it worked?
Oh, Daniel. I doff my Hamburg.
Yeah.
It means exactly that, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
If you go to the patents, there's a book out by Jerry Vassilatus called Secrets of the Cold War. It's a big, thick, wire-bound book, about yay thick. It's full of nothing but patents. And one of the patents is, well, many of the patents are very interesting. Siemens, the German firm, in 1955 takes out a patent for collimating X-rays. In other words, how do we create an X-ray laser?
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. 1955. By the time you get to Reagan and the Star Wars era, they have discovered what's known as the Mossbauer effect. And the Mossbauer effect, if you look at it, is what I think was behind the thinking of Edward Teller, that we could put up into orbit satellites that were effectively X-ray and gamma-ray laser satellites that would lase a gamma-ray beam through special materials that would act as the optical cavity for the laser under tremendous radioactive bombardment, like a nuclear explosion. The Mossbauer effect was, I think, the reasoning behind those early Star Wars satellite weapons systems.
Ah.
Now, if you stop and think about it, what I've just said is that the mini-nukes theory for 9/11 makes some sense if viewed from the standpoint of Star Wars and the Mossbauer effect, because you could literally let off a small nuclear weapon under the towers, and that collimated burst of gamma rays would effectively vaporize.
Mm.
There's Judy Wood's justification. Effectively vaporize those towers.
Oh.
Oh. Now here's the bad news. The bad news is they discovered subsequently that under certain conditions of acoustical stress, note that word, of acoustical stress,
okay,
those gamma ray lasing materials could be put under stress, release a coherent beam of gamma rays, which will do more than take your X-ray picture.
Ah.
Yeah. And you could do that over and over and over. You wouldn't destroy the weapon by setting off a nuclear weapon. You could do it over and over and over. Now tie that to electrostatic generators capable of generating a field of a strength of septillions of watts per square meter.
Wow, okay, yes.
And you've got... In my thinking, you've got a little problem. And the problem is, yeah, the technology is there. The concepts are there. All you need to do is engineer this stuff together, and voila, you've got your strategic weapons platform that's not nuclear in the sense of a bomb.
Amazing. Boy, you mentioned Judy Wood there, and one of the most fascinating things that came up around that whole dustification aspect was that it was some kind of space platform that mm-hmm. it was mm-hmm. emanating from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're pumping that kind of coherent energy, especially at that end of the spectrum, it stands to reason then you would get residual effects that could be mistaken for fallout effects of a more conventional nuclear bomb. In other words, you know, that would account for the tritium levels that were so high around ground zero and so on and so forth, and for the heat that was present there for months afterwards. So yeah, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that there was some exotic technology involved. And going back to Reagan and Gorbachev, yeah, that this was playing into the discussions that were occurring at that time.
Incredible. Well, we have to know that Gorbachev going in knew a lot about the UFO file because Andropov.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
You've done an amazing thing, which is that Andropov is practically the disclosure president of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, he really was. And the interesting thing we have to remember is that Andropov was one of Gorbachev's mentors.
Okay.
In other words, Gorbachev didn't get to where he was by being Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah, right.
There's no doubt in my mind that Gorbachev didn't come into those meetings with Reagan, you know, with a blank slate. You know, no way. And neither did Reagan. You know, let's be honest here. Neither did Reagan.
Do you think that Gorbachev revealing this recently at a press club incident a couple of years ago is intentional?
Yes. Yeah, I do. Because again, it's a signal that, you know, there's nothing that you guys over there in America can think of that we're not thinking of over here. Mm-hmm. It's a way of signaling that, yeah, we know all about this stuff and, you know, we're prepared to go there. But I, you know, the other thing about that negotiation that we're forgetting that probably was occurring was, okay, if we're taking nuclear weapons, bombs, essentially, to zero, then we're operating with the premise that there's something else available. So how do we, the United States and the Soviet Union, monitor and regulate each other's deployment of those types of things? Mm-hmm. And that's highly problematical because those things are very different. You know, for one thing, they're not big clunky bombs.
Right, yeah.
They're perhaps big, but not necessarily so clunky, and they're not going to have the same types of signatures that anything else would. So that would have been the proliferation problem that may have scuttled that whole thing. I don't know.
Oh, fascinating. We know that Reykjavik was that very unusual meeting, and this is where they had that conversation.
Right.
And where they suggested this zero option and where they left empty-handed because of Star Wars.
Right.
And then eventually they got this other treaty that the U.S. just recently pulled out of, which is right. unusual in itself. One last clip on the historical part. Kennedy, after his meetings with Khrushchev and after his battles over the UFO file and this strange kind of breakaway force in NASA doing things that he's trying to get his fingers on, and he's trying to see, where is this coming from? They seem to have their own structure when they're putting together programs like Blue Gemini. But at a certain point, he's visiting NASA a lot, and he's calling for the moon program. Mm-hmm. And behind the scenes, he's trying to call off the space race and do a joint moon mission.
Right.
That's on record at the Kennedy Library. I've seen the document, so it's nothing anyone can question. Kennedy, beyond that, though, there's another document where he says, I want you, November 12th, he writes to this central intelligence director, and he says, I want you to share our UFO material on these high-threat cases with the Soviet Unions, with the idea that they won't think it's us, you know, if it flies over their nuclear things. It's a safety
right.
issue, and he's kind of checkmating them.
Right.
And we know 10 days later, his assassination takes place.
Right.
Maybe they accelerated the schedule. They were already on there. But in any case, that move reminds me very much of the battle with Trump and the CIA coming in. The same thing, that same kind of pattern of them freaking out to get rid of him. In Kennedy's case, where this checkmating is going on, you've pointed out that it's this group, it is the von Braun, it's the post-war Nazi faction that freaks out the most. Because he's reaching into what? He's reaching into their special territory. So when we think of it like that, since that's the last real high point, flashpoint of this whole thing, aside from Reagan and Gorbachev, they were, that force resided somewhere in the CIA and in aerospace, which were the two places that Kennedy was reaching into. So JFK, in fact, threatening that thing that had been in process for two decades, creating this exotic technology.
Yes, and there's something else about the Kennedy thing that makes me think that we're looking perhaps at a bit of a replay. Because if you look at the factions involved in trying to get monopoly control, so to speak, of the whole UFO secret technology issue, front and center is the U.S. Navy and corporations like SAIC, which has a heavy Navy connection through Admiral Inman and so on. And again, Admiral Inman, there's intel for you again.
Yes.
But a different, I think, a different faction of it. Well, Kennedy, of course, is Navy.
Right.
And, you know, I've pointed this out before, that he might be acting also as kind of a cat's paw for that faction to try and gain control or regain or reassert control over things. And again, you see this in Trump to a certain extent via Roy Cohn and that whole connection with McCarthy and the Monmouth hearings and so on and so forth. Because again, you have this heavy Navy presence represented by the McCarthy faction going after the Army.
Right. And you've got Cohn practically interrogating these people.
Oh, yeah. He really is. And you can tell he's reading off of his checklist here. You know, I got to get this on the record and that on the record. It really appears to me that way, that you've got some sort of connection going on here that is representative of a factional infighting. And let's go back to that aerostatic generator patent, because at the very beginning of that patent, I put the link up in the blog, you can read that the patent is assigned to guess who? The Secretary of the Navy.
Oh, wow. Incredible. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we know there is that. That is that faction that's connected there, right in there. There's the famous story of Catherine Austin Fitz, Secretary Fitz, and them inviting her into this Navy program think tank to study the impact of extraterrestrial life announcement on the public. And when she shows up for those meetings, you know, it's these admirals, it's a CIA director. And so we get that, again, it's the Navy that seems to have some research aspect control on the UFO file.
Right.
But the CIA is always there.
That, to me, that whole episode with Secretary Fitz and then her walking away, that, to me, is representative of what their problem is they've got the technology. They don't know how to go about disclosing this. Because, and I'll be blunt, I view the potential of an ET disclosure here as cover story, because the real effect of that technology is financial in nature. Because what it means is we're moving away from a non-renewable supply of energy, which is the basis of the current financial system, to something that's open-ended and that literally has no limit once you have access to the technology that has access to that kind of zero-point energy type of physics. So if you start to put into place a financial system on that basis, you've got to make the technological disclosure. So how do you do it? Well, you create an ET threat, and in response to the ET threat, well, you've got to put lots of weapons up there, and that's the way you transition the financial system.
Oh yeah,
is through a fake war.
Wow, incredible. Incredible. It's interesting. It ties back to that patent again, because there is something on record that we can point to, which would be exactly that kind of a thing, which is, hey, here's some new technology you don't know about, and we're going to use it, you know, for asteroids.
Well, and read the patent, Daniel, because it, when you get into the technological specifics, it'll ring a bell.
Okay. I can't wait. Well, we're talking about that. This is fascinating. You're actually at the very heart of the question here, which is it's very clumsy and paranoid the way that they've been trying to do this disclosure here and disclosure there.
But I
also think that while they're using the threat thing now, they're just as likely to turn around and use the whole ET savior aspect after they've done with this part.
Sure, absolutely.
Those were the bad guys we fought with.
Yeah.
Now here are the good guys.
Yeah, that they could do both. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the problem, as I see it for them, is they have created a technology that, like I say, undercuts the entire global financial system. So, you know, this is a complex problem, needless to say. How do we bring out the technology without creating massive upheaval? Well, if you're going to have upheaval, well, let's have a war, because wars are nice ways to, number one, circumscribe traditional liberties and centralize things and centralize narratives and control and so on and so forth. So that, to me, is what I think this scenario looks like. You know, it could be other scenarios. I'm not saying this as an exclusive thing, but that's one scenario we have to consider.
Wow, absolutely. And it seems like, if anything, they're at a particularly sensitive point where the media is now involved. And we know the media takes their marching orders from that deep state establishment.
Yeah.
So if they're talking about it, and if they're devoting segments on CNN to it, we know they've reached a point where they are getting on board with a certain type of narrative. And every time you hear that narrative, they're always talking about Elizondo. They're always talking about TTSA.
Right.
Which doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make sense to me either, but we have to look at not just to the American media doing this. If you look at the Russian media, they've been doing these odd little UFO stories since about 2013, right around the time of the Chelyabinsk incident. So in other words, it looks to me like, there's some sort of global push on. And now this Oxford professor, who's Korean, incidentally, so, you know, throw that into the mix for whatever that's worth. But it appears to me that, you know, the push is on, and now we've got to watch how they start connecting memes together, because they're clearly preparing some sort of narrative in all of this. And we've got to be on our toes, because, again, I suspect eventually they're going to get around to discussing financial aspects of all of this. And let's be blunt. If they suspect that there is an extraterrestrial presence already on this earth that looks like us, walks like us, and quacks like us, then what do you do to safeguard the integrity of your national security? Well, number one, you put into place programs to detect who they are. There's your genetics. And number two, you deny them access to the financial sector. And how do you do that? Well, cryptocurrencies are one possibility. So we're watching all of this happen, and we're conditioned to think that these things are just kind of all chaotic and they're all happening and there's no coordination to any of it. And I think quite the reverse. I think there's a great deal of coordination, but it's very, very hidden.
Wow. It's really amazing when you look and you think about the careers of people like John Mack, for example.
Right.
Who, when he came out, and how Time Magazine gave him the cover and just, you know, stabbed him in the back, and everybody was out there saying, oh, this crazy man, he should be taken off, and his tenure should be removed, and all the rest of it. What a difference, you know.
10 years.
10 years makes, because suddenly, now we're in a position where they want to promote this guy coming out of the CIA with a very weird story and weird films. Films that aren't very good, by the way.
And again, what's interesting about the narrative that they're creating, Daniel, is, again, they're not referring to any of those UFO cases dating from the 50s on that showed hostile or threatening behavior. In other words, this all of this—it's what they're emphasizing is the newness of all of this,
right?
And that, to me, is what's extremely suspicious about all of this. They are creating a narrative, and it's that narrative that bothers me. It's as if all of that other previous research from Richard Dolan or Hastings or whoever didn't even exist. Mm-hmm. Not to mention Jessup and Kehoe and, you know, everybody. Frank Edwards, Thomas Keel. Townsend Brown. Yeah, all of them. All of them.
Incredible. Oh. It's a great point, too. You need to, though, remove that research. They must become unpersons, right? It has to go down the memory hole, because you need, in order to roll this stuff out, for people who haven't, if they go and look into it, they'll see the contradictions showing up all over the place. Yeah.
Exactly. And that would make people question, why this now? And that's my question, because you and I are both familiar with all of that literature, and it's definitely there. And much of it is not of an anecdotal nature that can be so easily dismissed.
Yes.
And that's the problem. So what have they done? Well, they've invented this cockamamie blue chickens narrative to drive this whole thing into absurdity and make that whole field kind of go away, so that they can come out with their new narrative. And it makes no sense.
They denigrated the whole thing with the junk conspiracy, and now they're like, look, we have professors and intelligence people, and they'll give you this dignified version, but it's the fake disclosure narrative.
Right.
And this brings us back to Rosen and von Braun when we started, really. Let's take her comments. I'm just going to read what she said verbatim about what von Braun told her.
Okay.
And then we're going to let's touch on that, and then I want to touch on Lazar.
Ah, wonderful. Okay, let's do it.
Okay, so this is an excerpt from a video interview with Carol Rosen. Quote, I met the late Dr. Werner von Braun in early 1974. At that time, von Braun was dying of cancer. But he assured me that he'd live a few more years in order to tell me about the game that was being played. That game being the effort to weaponize space, to control Earth from space, and space itself. Mm-hmm. What was most interesting to me, continuing the quote, was a repetitive sentence that he said to me over and over again that was, the strategy that was being used to educate the public and decision makers, and the scare tactics, the spin that was being put on as justification for our advanced weapons system, was based upon how we identify an enemy. The enemy at first, von Braun said, to justify our space weapons system, first the Russians are going to be considered the enemy, then terrorists would be identified, then we were going to identify third world crazies. The next enemy was asteroids, and against asteroids, we're going to build space-based weapons. Continuing the quote, and the funniest one of all was against what he called aliens, extraterrestrials. That would be the final card. And over and over and over, during the 4 years that I knew him and was giving his speeches for him, he would bring up that last card. Quote, and remember, Carol, the last card is the alien card. We're going to have to build space-based weapons against aliens, unquote. And all of it, he said, is a lie.
Uh-huh.
Where in von Braun's warning would you say we are?
Oh, I'd say we're at asteroids and moving into extraterrestrials. Yes. We're at the tail end of of the whole picture. And it's very interesting. The terrorist aspect of his warning did not get discussed very much.
True.
But I want to go back to a movie that appeared in the 1980s with Val Kilmer called Real Genius. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
Well, it's a movie where these basically genius young kids go off to some sort of special scientific academy, and they get to invent all sorts of cool stuff. And Val Kilmer is part of a secret project for the U.S. Air Force to build very powerful lasers and, get this, put them on airplanes to zap, so to speak, terrorists right out of their lawn chairs.
Oh.
And that's the way the film presents it. So, in other words, I think you're looking at, with the drone program and the GPS thing and all of that, you're looking at that aspect of it. So, in other words, we've moved way past that now.
Yes.
We're now into the asteroid ET part of the phase. We're sort of ending and transitioning the asteroid thing. And now we're starting to begin, let's put out the ET meme. And like Von Braun said, it's all a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find very interesting about her affidavit. It's all a lie.
Right.
And the interesting thing about the affidavit is, in her recounting of it, he does not indicate why it's a lie.
Right.
However, I'm willing to speculate, and it goes back to him bringing over Herman Oberth and that press conference where Oberth says, oh, well, we invented all that stuff because we had help.
Right.
In other words, that's the first indicator of the lie.
Okay.
That's the first indicator of the lie. Why? Because you do not need ET to explain all of that Nazi technology, even the Bell. If you buy the Bell story, then you can reverse engineer, as I attempted to do in the books, you can reverse engineer at least some of the major concepts that they were existing back then that they might have been experimenting with to create that technology.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it's like I put it in Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops. One of the interesting things that Otto Skorzeny mentions is that he saw some extraordinary technology right at the end of the war, and it would be a perfect way to conduct operations behind enemy lines.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, it's in Saucers, Swastikas, and Science.
Okay.
Well, what did he see? And, you know, since the war is ending, behind who, you know, what enemy lines are we talking about here?
Right.
In other words, he was himself kind of indicating an agenda of using advanced technology to create some sort of psyop
mm-hmm.
operation, which I find, you know, coming from him, an extremely interesting thing. And by the way, that episode was reported by Magda Goebbels.
Wow.
In her diaries.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You don't get any closer to the source than that. That's pretty
good.
No,
you don't get, and yeah. Wife of the propaganda minister, you know, who came up with such wonderful lines as, well, if the lie is big enough and you tell it often enough,
right, know, people will believe it.
People will believe it, yeah.
When we think about von Braun and the things that he went through in this position, first as Dornberger's understudy, getting recruited by the Americans, you know, and saving his mentor from the judgment at Nuremberg,
right,
and becoming the kind of darling of the NASA scene, this kind of remaking his image as this great guy. But things go wrong with him because nobody really knows why he leaves NASA, but you've mentioned before that he said something, he let out a little too much about the moon mission, and then suddenly he's gone.
Yeah, what I think happened was von Braun, and I remember seeing this as a kid, you know, I even wrote von Braun when I was 13 years old after the moon landing, wrote him a letter, you know, this is wonderful, great stuff. He sent me a letter back.
Wow.
And what he did, and I remember this came out in Time magazine, it was one of their little inserts at the bottom of the page.
Right.
What he did was he said that, yeah, he made reference to the space capsule reaching the equigravisphere, the neutral point of gravity between the Earth and the Moon. But the figure that he gave for that neutral point was about 23,500 miles from the surface of the Moon. And that's a big whoa. The reason being that if the Moon is 1/6 the gravity of the Earth, that equigravisphere neutral point is going to be about 43,000 miles from the surface of the Moon. Uh-huh. So what von Braun just said was, it's a lot more massive than we have been led to believe.
And that means
that little rocket on the LEM ain't going to get us off there.
Right. Okay.
All by its lonesome. So, you know, to my mind, what he just gave out was not that Apollo was hoaxed in the sense that the Apollo hoaxers mean it, but it was a hoax in the sense that rockets weren't the only technology involved. Think Kurt Davis, senior flight director during Apollo at Cape Canaveral. His specialty is not even rockets. It's plasmas.
Well, you're back in Bell territory.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would be remiss not to at least mention torsion physics here, since mm-hmm. we mentioned the Bell and such. I find over and over again when I mention this, people don't understand exactly what it is. Can you just give kind of a...
Torsion?
Yeah.
Torsion is a twist in the fabric of space-time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to think about it, just think about it like an empty soda can. This is my soda can analogy. Just take an empty soda can and wring it like a dish rag. And what happens is the can crumples and the ends draw closer together.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens. And if you draw a lattice work on the can, that twists that lattice work. So in mathematical descriptions of torsion, you have to use the tensor calculus to describe that twist. Now, the thing is, when you look at torsion in standard physics, it's not a very big effect. You've got two mathematical expressions of it. You've got the Einstein-Cartan torsion tensor, which is a very minimal effect. So it tends to be discounted by physicists when they look at general relativity and things like that. But there's another tensor version of torsion called the Ricci tensor, R-I-C-C-I. And the Ricci tensor is a bit more sophisticated in that it deals with dynamic torsion. In other words, systems of torsion within systems of torsion within systems of torsion. And in that expression, it's a much more pronounced effect. And it's very interesting when you look at Einstein, when he starts delving into unified field theories after general relativity, which came out in 1916. Some of the things he's playing around with in these unified field theories are things like parallelism and torsion and so on and so forth to try and get a unified field effect. So, yeah, he's thinking in those terms himself. But the real clue for me, Daniel, was Gabriel Krohn. And I first mentioned this gentleman in Secrets of the Unified Field because Krohn was not a theoretical physicist. He was an electrical engineer. And what he essentially said in a paper that was published by MIT in 1934, then in Europe in 1935, he wins a prize for this paper, is that you can use the tensor calculus to describe electrical anomalies that engineers encounter in large rotating electrical systems, okay? What he just told you was, number one, torsion is not an insignificant effect. Number two, all of that hyperdimensional mathematics that is in general relativity or in the unified field theories in the 1920s is applicable directly on the laboratory bench in describing electrical systems and their transients. So what he's also just said is all electrical systems, from simple circuits like your refrigerator or your microwave to much more complex ones, what he's also just said is that every electrical system is a hyperdimensional machine.
Hmm.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So
that's quite a revelation.
Yeah. Especially when you encounter him being at General Electric in Schenectady, New York, and you have certain senators from Wisconsin probing into security matters there. So, yeah.
McCarthy and Monmouth again.
McCarthy and Monmouth.
People need to get the book on that and watch the interview we did on it. And I understand that maybe there's a follow-up on that coming too.
I'm working on a, not necessarily a follow-up to the book, but kind of a more generalized look at, you know, just what the heck is going on back then, from the 30s on up, because the more you get into it, it's evident that the standard history just is not capable of holding much water.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think you've proven that. You've definitely proven that. Let's round out von Braun this way. After that incident happens and he says these things, suddenly he goes away into Fairchild Industries. Mm-hmm. Private company after being at NASA. It's rather sudden. Then he's there. What is going on with him when he's working with Rosen that he wants to share this? Somehow he's feeling like he's been bamboozled, or his aspect of the deep state that he was working with, he's not so happy with them, and he decides to let this out to her. He must assume, in my mind anyway, that she's going to share it at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he would have had to. Again, we're speculating here because there's not much to go on about that period of his life. But my suspicion is that von Braun going to Fairchild is part of this privatization of the whole UFO secret technology issue that occurs. He goes to Fairchild when who's in office? Richard Nixon.
Right.
And what do some of the Majestic 12 documents say about Richard Nixon? Well, he privatized it. He turned it all over to the military-industrial complex. So I have always viewed von Braun going to Fairchild as part of that process. In other words, they created a cover story, and they got rid of him from NASA for that remark and shunted him into a place where he could be watched and controlled much more closely. And I suspect that by that point, von Braun, given his remarks to Rosen, I suspect that at that point he saw what the game was and didn't like it very much, because he'd been a considerable part of it, number one. Mm-hmm. But by that point, it's become evident that whoever is ultimately in charge of it is driving it, you know, with a massive global agenda behind it. And he doesn't want to be a part of it and wants to expose it. You know, he's got cancer. He knows the end of his life is approaching. So it's his mea culpa, so to speak.
Right. Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. When I think about it, I think it's interesting that he's going back to space weapons.
Yes.
And again, SDI, Star Wars, space weaponry.
Yes.
And Trump says we have to make space a war-fighting domain. We have treaties, of course, against weapons in space, but how does that hold any water? It looks like if they start building them, the other starts building them, and that's the end of that. But so much of this is about weaponizing space, but to control what's going on down here.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. They're literally trying to move all of the control infrastructure off planet. And you can see this in the early Brookings reports when they start talking about weather satellites and financial clearing in terms of, you know, satellite-based financial clearing. Well, is the UFO going to be a national security issue if you're planning to do that? Well, of course it is. And this, I think, is part of the motivation behind all of this, that they're trying to move all of the infrastructure for controlling the planet and the population on the planet into space. And over and over, and this again is stressed in that Val Kilmer movie that came out in the 1980s. You know, if you're acting up, well, we'll just zap you, you know, as you're sitting on your porch in your lawn chair and, you know, turn you into little cinders.
It's not a very pretty prospect.
It's not a very pretty prospect, but, you know, it's nonetheless very real. And given, you know, given the technologies that we've been discussing, and for someone like Von Braun, you know, having spent a lifetime mixed up with the monsters that he was mixed up with, you know, you approach the end of your life and you're thinking, you know, my God, this can't stand. It just cannot go on. So, yeah, I think they're trying to do all of this. It's a huge move. And, you know, if we can get people afraid of E.T. or thinking E.T. is going to come and save us, you know, so much the better, because that essentially makes everybody passive.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And if they can tie it to climate change, they'll finally be able to ram that down our throats.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah. We've got the technology, you know, let us control the climate. You pay your taxes so that we can do it.
Yes.
You know, and like I've said before, weather derivatives are a handy thing to have around when you can control the weather.
Right.
Disaster capitalism.
Incredible. Joseph, this has been fascinating. Absolutely incredible. Obviously, we're deep in the soup when it comes to these revelations, and we're watching them close, but your site is GizaDeathStar.com. The new book is McCarthy, on McCarthy and the Monmouth hearings. Just fascinating material, and we hope to have you back real soon.
Certainly. Glad to be here.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Remember to go to darkjournalist.com to subscribe now and be a member. The inside track that we're putting together for this summer with amazing guests like Graham Hancock, Catherine Austin Fitz, you don't want to miss. See you soon.